I'm sorry I'm not with you in person this morning, but as you may recall, last Sunday I said I had a bit of a cold, a good Scottish cold I called it. Through the week I developed a little bit of a cough, and on Thursday morning decided I'd better phone the doctor. So I got some advice and she confirmed it really was just a cold. But then in the evening there was the advice that came from the government about people with coughs staying at home. So I thought I'd best do as I was told, set a little bit of an example I hope for others to follow. And so I will be watching online this morning along with you. This morning I wasn't going to so much preach to you anyway. I was going to share with you a chapter of this wonderful book that I bought just a few weeks ago. It's called The Day I Met Jesus, written by Frank Viola and Mary DeMuth. And what it does in this book is try to see some of the Bible stories from through the eyes of the women that the story is about, and in particular this Sunday, the Samaritan woman at the well. What this story does is try to give her a bit of a backstory, a little bit about her background. Who were these five husbands that Jesus seemed to know about? What was her past? And I hope in sharing this with you, you will see and hear this story in a new way. So, the diary of a desperate Samaritan woman. I've never wanted to write my story because no happy ending existed. Besides, who would want to read my woeful words, and why? Instead, my life played like Job's tragedy without his restoration, tied with a twisted thread of betrayal. Always, always, I would think on the years past, saddened by the tangle of them, thinking God had forgotten my life, my dreams. My stomach kept itself in knots while people pointed and wagged their heads. But now, O glorious grace, awakening now. I write these words with wild expectation, with sudden joy, because a man told my story to me straight, and with that changed its ending forever. But before I write of my parched soul now quenched, I must take you back to the moment I withered. There had been an old era when water meant life to me. My first husband, Hezron, had met me by Jacob's well in those carefree halcyon days, the well that I ventured to today. He playfully called it his well, though we both knew its real origin. His words still sang through me, "You are more spectacular than the sunrise." I blushed under such words and said nothing in response. Could he really find me so attractive? His eyes affirmed so, I believed, like a naive girl. And I believed he spoke the truth, and I blossomed in the light of it. "And our children," he said with the same affection, "will carry your beauty and my wit." And with that, he winked. I dared to whisper, "I hope so," but the dry wind carried my words. Like those around us, parents arranged our marriage. But I had no parents, no ketubah to give his family. Beautiful, but moneyless, he told me. But when he said it, his eyes sparkled and his smile dimpled. "You are my ketubah, my dry doubts, my sweet dowry promise," he said then, holding my face in his hands. I drank in Hezron's words like the thirstiest girl in Samaria, with a mother and father sleeping long in their graves on the hillside. I lived under the shadow of an angry aunt. Hezron's love gave me hope and a means to escape her servitude. We secreted a way to marry despite the protests of others. Once we were settled into our home, people began to accept us. Hezron's love lasted 4 months. Writing it now still brings heartache. When my belly did not swell with child, his face soured and his brow furrowed. After 6 months, his voice harshened. "What kind of womb refuses my gift?" His questions were not meant as an invitation to conversation. They became angry declarations of my unworthiness. With as much love as he first had, sacrificing his reputation to be with me, he now hated me with the same vigour. He could not even look my way. He would not, but he would have me nonetheless. 9 months passed since we married, and Hezron snapped like a dry twig underfoot. He lifted his hand, threatened to hit me, only to recoil, then cry, then beg me to forgive him for such threats. He bounced between madman and saint. I learned to read each mood, either cowering or welcoming him, and always seducing him to bed in hopes of winning his affections through the gift of a baby. The family he betrayed by whisking me away for marriage became another Caesar in his life. They mercilessly tore at me with their words, throwing around worthless and barren, like a farmer tosses seeds. Those words implanted themselves into my heart and grew into acacia trees, monuments of my worthlessness. I became desperate to bear Hezron's child. I visited midwives with special potions. I stood behind mandrake plants. But like Rachel, my hopes died. I prayed to the God of my ancestors, bargaining with him to please have mercy upon my womb. But he fell as silent as my husband had become. For a full year, we endured my empty womb. On our anniversary, Hezron touched my stomach. His hand waited on my abdomen. And he shook his head, "You are an unfit wife." 4 chilling words given as if he were evaluating livestock, cold, hard, and detached. "I am praying," I said. "The Almighty has closed your womb for a reason, to give me permission to be free of you," he spat his condemnation. And I received it as daggers into my already obliterated heart. I had failed him. God had failed me. Then Hezron thrust a parchment my way, a certificate of divorce already signed, the law of the land, a decree proving my barrenness. "I'm doing you a favor," he said. "You can live free." Except that free meant homelessness, emptiness, an undying thirst for the love he had once had for me, now dried up in the drought of Hezron's wind-shifted affections. On the morning of the divorce, I stood under an angry sun, beneath the fickle affections of a God who denied my prayers. Barefooted, I walked alone to our trysting place, that terrible well that began with hope, but ended on the heels of bereavement. Hezron had no legal reason to give me any money when he dismissed me, since I had no kedupa. I used what would have been my dowry on burial sites years ago when my parents succumbed to the fever. And now I stood at the well, barren and without resource. As the years marched by, I picked up small jobs, gathering sticks, cooking for women whose bellies produce babies aplenty. I lived as a ghost with dreams, watching others live my hope of family, but never participating. Worthless and barren embodied who I had become. I lived my life with head down, empty eyes, never meeting a soul. The small jobs dried up, and I forced myself to move to a nearby village. I naively hoped that a fresh start would mean a new life. So I married again, hoping to quell the pain deep inside of me. I walked this earth to simply be beholden to a man, however he saw fit. When my womb remained empty, my second husband grabbed me by the hair and threw me into the streets. No one wants a barren woman, no matter how much she gives. This lesson pierced my soul like a flint knife. 2 more husbands became temporary. They cycled into my life, then out again as each one discovered my secret. I longed to distance myself from the memory of Hezron, the well, the one small moment I fell in love. Judah changed everything. He found me weeping, bereft of joy, as I picked up firewood on the outskirts of civilization. My hands dirty, my eyes wet. I only saw 2 sandaled feet as I knelt on the earth, pulling a large branch from scrub. "Why is a lovely woman like you crawling so close to the ground? Solomon's palace would not suffice such a face." He shielded his eyes from the sun and then coughed. I looked at him, tall as timber, shook my head. "I'm making my way, gathering wood is what I do." "I am Judah." He extended his hand to me and pulled me to my feet, such easy effort. I wipe my hands on my tunic, and I am dusty. We walked back to the village that evening as the sun faded to pink and blue, then deep purple. I told him my story, and he told me his. Life had broken him, his wife taking her last breath as she pushed a stillborn into this cruel world. Later, he asked to marry me. I put my hand up as if to halt him. I am barren. I can give you no children. I have told you this already. I want a wife, Judah said, not a mother. We married quietly and commenced our companioned life together, measured in happy days, conversation, and hushed dreams. Except that God severed Judah's dreams on this earth. The cough I had noticed in our brief courtship monstered into blood-soaked cloths lifted to dry lips. I loved him all those 180 days, loved him like my own life. And when he bled his last breath, all my vitality drained from me. I hunted the hills unawake and dead of heart. I considered exiling myself to Palestine in the land of the Jews. I'd heard rumors of a man who welcomed outcasts, who was kind to widows, who fed thousands. Perhaps he would dignify me. But my brief foray to that land only ended in slanderous rants and racial epithets. Such hatred compelled me back to my people. In all, 5 Samaritan husbands had me. 4 husbands used my body, then dismissed me. Only one loved me, but my happiness died with him. I shook my fist at the Almighty, daring him to take my life and be over with it. Why should I remain here on this earth? Without a child, I had no legacy, no hope, no reason to live. There existed none to carry on my traits or my lineage or my sorry story. What beckoned me back to Sichar, where I write my tale? One enticing man in the graves of my parents. When this new man told me where he lived, I remembered the comfort I used to feel visiting my parents on the hillside. And he used all of Hezron's words, words like beautiful, love, and want. He seduced me, only to recoil against me in the aftermath. You are so very safe, he said. What do you mean? I said, as I rose from his sleeping mat, propping my chin on my shaking hand. The shame inside me burned. Never before had I slept with a man who was not my husband. Half of me worried God would strike me dead. The other half did not care if he did. My life mirrored my womb. I'm married, he said. I did not think my heart could break any more, but with those words, it shattered into dread. But you are useful to me. You are alone, no? Yes, I am alone. 4 more words, a declaration of my life. And you need food. He traced his rough hand over the diminishing curve of my hip where the bone protruded. Yes. But what I wanted to say was I need more than food, more than water, more than shelter. You will be my worker, he said. Live within my house, take care of my children. Do work so my wife will not have to labor. And then in the evening, I knew what he meant. I did not argue with myself whether this would be good or bad. It was simply my lot, to be used, to live for the sake of another, losing myself, my dreams, and my desires completely. A barren, widowed woman could hope for no more. This morning, I tried to shake the dark memories from my head. They played like cautionary tales during nightmares, only to retell themselves in the light of the day. With those memories in mind, I grabbed the empty vessel and made the hot, dusky trek to Hezron's terrible well, the place where betrayal had entered my life. I walked with the shame of my past and the guilt of my present, like a heavy camel skin pressed on sweaty shoulders during the heat of the day. I could not remove the weight. I could not escape it. My body memorized the routine. Walk the dusty road, head down, drop the earthen vessel into the well's deep throat, and lug and lurch its contents home. only to perform the same duty again and again and again, all under the watchful stare of the unrelenting sun. I trudged there alone at noon hour, as was my custom. I dared not draw water in the morning like the other women, to avoid their snickers and stares. They gossiped my current story to death, every nuance. Even the children knew. They held up five fingers as a reminder of my husband's. Old women shook their heads at me when I walked the town. Men leered. I've heard it said that a barren woman must always send herself to get water because she has no children to bear the weight of labour. Halfway to the well, I wondered again, or was it the 100th time, why I was here in Samaria. What is the reason God placed me on this sullen earth? Does he create people simply to be used and abused? Has his favour shone only on the Jews, only on the strong, only on men, only on women whose wombs produced babies? He certainly did not shine upon me, even as the sun relentlessly accosted me on my long, lonely walk. I did not know then what I shout with joy now. God loves the weak. When I arrived, the usual vacant well had a visitor, a man sitting near the well's mouth. No horse or camel accompanied him, so I wondered if he'd travelled on foot by himself. I sighed. His silhouette brought me back to Hezron's dancing eyes and the flutter of my heart in this very spot. Days long stolen. With the sun-washed hillside around him and the noonday sun shining on the top of his head, he sat perfectly still. Completely at peace, it seemed. He did not stand when I entered the circle of the well. Instead, he seemed like a fixture there, a statue that had always been erected. I rubbed my eyes. He lingered there, still quiet under the treeless sky, his clothes rumpled from days upon day of travel, it seemed. As I neared the man, his garments revealed that he was a Jew. But Jews did not journey alone through Samaria. He sat quietly there like he waited for someone. He looked up finally, his eyes tired, and yet more alive than any man's eyes I'd ever seen. I thought to myself, can eyes really dance? Can they smile, sing? Because this man's eyes performed all three while welcoming me to his desolate spot of earth. I said nothing to him, but he held my gaze. A bead of sweat meandered down his face, but he did not wipe it away. The day mustered to swelter us both. I dropped my dipper into the deep well. As I drew near, he turned toward me and looked deeply into my eyes. I had a strange feeling that he knew me. He smiled confidently, paused, cleared his throat, and reached out his hand. Would you please give me a drink? His voice sounded parched, nearly dried up, but it was his words that stunned me into silence. What kind of holy man dared to talk to me in public? But not just any man, a Jew, as his accent gave his lineage away. A Jewish man talking to me, wanting only water and nothing more. Jews had treated my people like dogs, as utter outcasts to their exclusivity on the Almighty. And here this tired man stooped to ask me for a drink. I looked around, wondering if this were a trap. I heard rumours of Jewish holy men entrapping women like me in compromising situations. I swallowed hard, my tongue thick in my mouth, but I could not hold back my curiosity. You are a Jew and I am a Samaritan. How can you ask me for a drink? What I really thought was that you Jews will not even talk to Samaritans unless perhaps you want something from us. But something about this man prevented those words from leaving my mouth. I saw kindness in his eyes, and I heard compassion in the timbre of his voice, something so compelling and alien that I could not let my sarcasm out. If you knew God's gift and who I am, he said, you would be asking me for living water, and I would give it to you. A rather arrogant thing to say, seeing that he had brought nothing to draw water. Sir, I said, this well is over 100 feet deep and you have no wooden dipper and no flaxen cord. Where are you going to get this living water? I wanted him to know I considered the patriarch Jacob, my father, just as the Jews claimed him to be. I've always wanted to tell a Jew that we Samaritans are not half-breeds like they say we are. So I asked, are you greater than our father Jacob who dug this well and drank from it? As I said those words, I remembered the face of Hezron. For the first time in 12 years, I recalled the kindness he once had, coupled with the kindness of this man. I wondered perhaps if he would love me. He gestured towards the well. If you keep coming to this well, you will always thirst. But if you drink the water I offer you, you will never thirst again. In fact, the water that I give will flow from within you forever. I did not understand what he said. How can water flow from within a person? Water came from the earth, simple as that. But he spoke so confidently, with a spark of love radiating from his eyes. And I felt a sense of care and acceptance coming from him that I'd only experienced from dear, dear Judah. But life had hardened my heart like clay earth, wholly parched, drained of all its lifeblood, baked impenetrable by hatred and rejection. I wanted this man's magic water for some temporary relief. I sighed, then looked upon his face. Sir, give me this water so that I will not get thirsty and I have to keep coming here to draw water. Oh, how I meant those words. And for a sacred second, I believed this man would give me exactly what I wanted. Go call your husband and come back. The wind inside me exhaled into the hot, thick air. So there was a special trick to receive such a blessing. I have to have a husband. Little in my life made sense. He sliced open the biggest wound in my heart with his words. I dropped my head and whispered, I have no husband. Silence. I waited for his judgment and withdrawal. He would abandon me as all others had, or sneer, or expose me. But strangely, he did not move, so utterly peaceful like a calmed sea. He simply drew my attention in a way that wooed me. He smiled and said, you are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. So what you have said is quite true. I froze. How could he possibly know that, and why would he so brazenly say these things out loud? The shame inside me warmed my face, blushing my expression. I said nothing, trying to understand how this man knew my story. I realized that the Jews might be right and prophets exist. Was he a holy prophet, yet one with heart? After all, he offered me living water with all the while knowing my story. Would he recoil and shift to angry judgment, grab my hair at the scalp and throw me to the ground? Would he use me for his pleasure and gain? Kindness played no role in my life. Anyone acting kind only wanted something from me. Instead of walloping in that inevitability with this man, I changed the topic of conversation. We Samaritans worship on Mount Gerizim, and you Jews worship on Mount Zion. Which of us is correct? Miss, he said, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. The rebuke was kind, but he spoke with authority. Nevertheless, I thought, always the Jews, always their special place in God's heart, never Samaritans. Perhaps this is why my story is sad. I belong to an unfavored race. These thoughts stirred me, but I did not voice them. I sat down near the well to hear the rest of his words, and he continued holding my eyes with his. Yet a time is coming, and has now come, when the true worshippers will worship the Father in the Spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks. When he says seeks, my insides hearkened, pregnant with love. Could it be? Could it really be that God seeks me to be his worshipper? A five-time married Samaritan now sleeping with another woman's husband. Why would he notice me? But the man's demeanor towards me seemed to indicate the irresistible truth. I am sought. God in spirit. He pointed skyward and smiled, and his worshippers must worship in the spirit and in truth. We Samaritans do not believe in prophets after Moses, except for the one prophet who we are all waiting for, a prophet like Moses himself. The Jews called him the Messiah. We called him Taheb, the Restorer. When the Messiah comes, I told him, he will explain all of these deep things to us. I am the Messiah. Could it be? The stirring inside me believed it, but to be honest, fear prevented me from rejoicing in this revelation. Those four words strung together would change my story forever. The Restorer of the world revealed his identity to me. At that moment, voices sounded nearby. The man's companions arrived, his disciples, I summarized. They shot judgment my way, and I could feel the words they did not voice. Why are you talking to a Samaritan, and a woman no less? Still drunk from his Taheb declaration, I made a choice to shrug off their quiet accusations. In that moment, he satiated my lifelong thirst, as if clear, cool water drenched me, refreshed in the heat of the day. It baptized my head, rushed down my throat, settled in my stomach, and permeated my thirsty heart. Anchored to the dusty earth, I knew this longed-for truth. I am loved. So very, utterly noticed, picked, wanted, despite my story. Or maybe because of it, I am not sure. But one thing I am assured of is this: God saw fit to notice me, to make himself known to me quietly in the place of my betrayal and shame. Living water met me at high noon. I heard the Messiah laugh as he watched this transformation unfold in me. While evil had taken a lifetime to destroy me, this man took mere moments to restory me. His eyes laughed and danced and sang. We shared a knowing look as if he saw the tragedy of my story in its entirety and resurrected it to new purpose. And then he said, "Dare to live your life well." What tragedy happened in the doldrums of my past has now become a wellspring of grace, covering all the shame, sin, and a lifetime of accumulated regret. Under the hot sun, I drank in this grace of a new life, gulped it deep, clasped my hands to my chest, because I felt my heart would overflow its borders and spill onto and into the crowd. One man motioned to the Messiah, then called him Jesus. Jesus, such a common name for a man bent on blessing us all. And in that moment, I knew this sweet gift of living water was not merely meant for me, but for all of Sychar. I found my feet, and with my eyes opened wide, I ran home to Sychar, my heart full of living, breathing, enlivening water. Halfway there, I realized I'd left my container at the well, but I spared no extra running to retrieve it. Telling others about living water made a simple water vessel unimportant. I dared to speak to the elders of Sychar about Jesus, the Taheb, the Restorer, the Messiah. I met the looks of gossipy women and instead danced in their presence. I grasped the hands of children holding up five fingers and I laughed. With tears wetting my face and joy permeating my soul, I entreated them, "Come, see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this man be the Restorer, the Messiah? He's at the well of Jacob. Come and see." One man said, "Is this the woman who never speaks to us? What could have happened to her? Let us go and see." It must have been my sheer excitement or perhaps the weight of the word Messiah. But once I sang it out loud, "Come and see," many followed me to meet Jesus at the well. Did they follow because they were puzzled by my transformation? Or were they just curious? Jesus stood on the hill near the well and watched us all approach. Gesturing to the crowd, he said, "Lift up your eyes and look upon the fields. They are white and ready to harvest." One of the Sychar elders approached him. He bowed slightly. "This woman has given witness that you know everything about her." He pointed to me. "Something indeed has happened to her. We wish to hear more of your words." The Messiah seemed to radiate. After hearing Jesus speak, the elders invited him to dine tonight in Sychar. And he gracefully and graciously accepted. This evening, Samaritans and a Jew will break bread together. We will share stories of lament and renewal and hope and the kingdom of God for all people, even Samaritans with painful pasts. No man has ever spoken words like this man. His words feed life. They behold hope. They gush truth. It is hard for me to believe what has taken place today. My story is no longer a rejection tale to mourn, but a beautiful epic to hope for. God has given me another chance, and I am heading to feast now. Amen.